Today is Wednesday, May 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump downplays modeling predicting a surge of COVID-19 cases.
Those projections are without mitigation. We're doing a lot of mitigation.
Plus, new research shows earlier cases of COVID-19 than previously known.
A French hospital discovered that it treated a man who had COVID-19 nearly a month before the French government confirmed its first cases.
And hours before her murder, Lesotho's former first lady made a surprising decision. We'll have those stories and more next. The global tally of confirmed COVID-19 cases is nearing 3.7 million, with over 257,000 deaths. The number of new confirmed cases in the United States continues to rise by more than 20,000 a day, and the daily death tolls sit between 1,000 and 2,000 people. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday said the White House Coronavirus Task Force would continue its work on the pandemic, focusing on vaccines and therapeutics, a day after Vice President Mike Pence said the administration was considering the end of May or early June to shift management of the national response back to federal agencies instead of the task force. On Tuesday, President Trump visited an aerospace facility in Arizona that now makes masks for healthcare workers after largely staying in at the White House during the pandemic. The visit to a key election battleground state is the first in a series of trips designed to highlight Trump's efforts to combat COVID-19, as his administration dismisses a report predicting a surge in coronavirus deaths. White House correspondent Patsy Wittig-Uswara has that story.
U.S. President Donald Trump toured the Honeywell Aerospace facility in Phoenix, Arizona, that's now producing masks for healthcare workers.
Various countries have been sent some very bad masks from other places. There's nothing like that at Honeywell.
Arizona is a key battleground state in this fall's U.S. presidential election. This is Trump's first venture out of the White House other than a trip to a presidential retreat and his March send-off of a Navy hospital ship headed to New York. The White House highlights these high-profile events, as well as Trump's various roundtables, which some observers say raises questions about what's actually getting done. Tim Voges teaches operational effectiveness at the Vanderbilt University Owen Graduate School of Management.
What it has been less of is the attention to the everyday operational detail, working in accountability and really closely tracking how much is getting produced in terms of tests and what are the updates about specific amounts that are out in the field and how are they doing and how are they performing? What about personal protective equipment? How much is being put into the field?
Overshadowing Trump's visit, a whistleblower complaint from a top American vaccine scientist, Rick Bright. The former director of Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority at the National Institutes of Health said he was demoted after refusing to promote hydroxychloroquine. That's the controversial drug Trump has touted to treat COVID-19 patients. Lina Wen is a public health professor at George Washington University.
It would be extremely concerning if our top scientists and doctors in the federal government are not able to do their part and make recommendations based on the best available science and evidence.
Trump is wrapping up the work of the White House Coronavirus Task Force and focusing on the next phase of dealing with the pandemic.
USA! USA!
He wants states to reopen their economies, showing support for rallies like these, despite a report predicting a surge in coronavirus deaths around 3,000 per day, almost double the current tally.
Those projections are without mitigation. We're doing a lot of mitigation. And we have to keep our country. Our country wants to open.
Patsy Wittig-Uswara, VOA News.
The UN Human Rights Office warns overcrowding, unhygienic conditions, and lack of medical care in prisons across North and South America are causing the rapid spread of COVID-19 in many facilities. Lisa Schlein has those details.
UN officials gave no precise figures, but they say thousands of prisoners throughout the region have been infected with the coronavirus. They say fear of contagion among prison populations and lack of adequate health care for those who have fallen ill has triggered deadly riots in some detention facilities. In the latest such incident on May 1st, reports say 47 inmates lost their lives during a violent revolt in Los Llanos Penitentiary in Venezuela. Prisoners also have been killed or injured in recent protests in Peru and Colombia. UN human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says many prisoners have tried to escape substandard conditions in detention facilities in Argentina, Brazil and Colombia, Mexico and the United States.
The scale and gravity of the incidents mentioned above seem to indicate that in some cases, states have not taken appropriate measures to prevent violence in detention facilities, and also indicate that state agents may have committed use of force violations in attempts to regain control of these facilities.
The UN agency is calling for investigations into the circumstances of the deaths and injuries during riots. It is urging states to take appropriate measures to prevent further spread of the coronavirus by ensuring sanitary conditions, widespread testing, and health care for inmates. Colville says the high number of COVID-19 infections recorded in prisons in the United States is a major concern, given the huge number of people incarcerated, some 2.3 million. He says another big concern is the large numbers of people held in immigration detention centers.
We're concerned that maybe there's not enough testing being going on in those immigration and customs enforcement centers. That said, you know, a lot of people have been released. I don't have precise figures, but it looks like it's in the tens of thousands of people have been released across the country.
Colville says conditions in detention centers and prisons should be regularly monitored by independent bodies. He adds prisoners who become infected with COVID-19 should be put in non-punitive isolation or quarantined in facilities where they can receive appropriate medical care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A study by French scientists suggests a man was infected with COVID-19 as early as December 27th of last year. It's nearly a month before France confirmed its first cases and could be important in assessing when and where the new coronavirus emerged. To learn more, I spoke to journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris via WhatsApp.
Well, this study was quite interesting here in France, and a lot of media buzzed around it. It was published in the International Journal of Microbial Agents, and basically they find out that this patient who was diagnosed on December 27th is a 42-year-old person. He lives in France, and basically he works at a grocery store as a fishmonger, and that's how they thought he catched the virus. He did not travel to China. He has no connection with China, and they think that because he's serving sushi to clients who might have connection with the airports and traveling to China, that might be, it's a possibility, how he catch the virus. So he described, you know, his symptoms as, you know, pulmonary infection. So back in the time, they didn't know it was COVID-19, but they kept the test back in the lab. And when the epidemic starting getting a lot of attention in France, they're starting running back some tests that it did previously from the beginning of the official start of the epidemic in France. And that's how they find out that this person was diagnosed on December 27th. We have to mention that he had mild symptoms, nothing severe. He went to hospital like for 3 days, and after he was sent back home. So right now he's okay, his family is okay, but it's quite astonishing for French doctors and scientists here to find out that basically they had such a case early on in the epidemic.
So Nico, if this actually does go back significantly further than people originally thought, what are organizations like the WHO, the World Health Organization, saying about these findings?
Well, what I've seen is that the WHO, and even in Italy, they think that they're going to find out more cases like that. So I think what's very important, and I think right now there is this diplomatic battle between Washington and Beijing about the origin of the virus, is that the timetable of the epidemic, which was supposed to occur early December in China, might be way earlier. And I think that as we tend to learn more and more on the virus and its origin, I think we're going to find more cases like that. And especially in Italy, they are right now trying to confirm early cases like the one that we have in France.
Nicolas Pinault is a journalist based in Paris, France. For some Egyptians, the impact of the coronavirus shutdown has been more frightening than the virus itself, which has infected thousands and killed hundreds in early May. With businesses closed, the poor are getting poorer. Now, as Egypt is starting to slowly reopen, medical experts warn the nation can't handle a larger outbreak. VOA's Heather Murdoch takes things from here.
These women are waiting for hours for food assistance in Cairo. It's crowded, but many aren't wearing masks because they say they can't afford them. And they're not alone. One in three people in Egypt live below the poverty line. And for many of them, the mandated coronavirus business shutdowns have made it impossible to afford enough food. This is Marusa Mustafa. She used to support her family of eight cleaning a school. Now schools are closed and she relies on government assistance, which helps feed about 3 million people in Egypt, just 10% of the nation's poor. In the coming weeks, the Egyptian government plans to lift some restrictions, like allowing hotels and some other businesses to open and shortening the nighttime curfew. And while this may relieve some of the pressure on Egypt's poor, experts warn that Egypt's hospitals are already overwhelmed and cannot handle a larger COVID-19 outbreak if the country opens too fast. For VOA News, I'm Heather Murdoch reporting from Istanbul with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
And coming up later,
Portland, Oregon mom Whitney Rutz has been bringing some sweetness to those fighting the coronavirus outbreak. What started as a way to help herself and raise money for a local food bank has brought some home-baked comfort to frontline medical workers.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Children have mostly been spared from the disastrous effects of COVID-19, but doctors in the UK and in New York are starting to suspect a link between COVID-19 and a small rise in the number of cases of children with symptoms similar to a rare but serious condition called pediatric multi-symptom inflammatory syndrome. A recent health alert by the New York City Health Department says 15 children between the ages of 2 and 15 with symptoms compatible to this condition have been hospitalized, some in intensive care units. The UK's Pediatric Intensive Care Society says many, but not all, of the children with symptoms of this syndrome have also tested positive for COVID-19. Health officials say the condition and its link with COVID-19 requires more study, but so far it appears to be rare. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hours before she was shot dead on the outskirts of the capital, Lesotho's former first lady, Lipolilo Tabane, made a surprising decision. Reuters reporter Francesca Lana has more.
In a new twist to the murder scandal, which has attracted rare international attention to the tiny kingdom. Lipolilo agreed to divorce her husband, Prime Minister Thomas Tabane, after years of refusing to make way for her rival. That's according to a well-connected businessman named Tuboho Mojapela, who met with Lipolilo to mediate. The meeting was confirmed by Lipolilo's friend and confidant, Tato Sibola, who was present. It was on the way home from meeting with Mojapela and telling him that she was ready to free her husband that she was murdered in her car. 2 days after the killing, Tabane, now 80, was sworn in for a second term. And 2 months later, he married Dipolelo's rival, Mayasaya. Police charged Mayasaya with Dipolelo's murder in February and named Tabane as a suspect, although he has yet to be formally charged in court. They both deny any involvement. On the evening in question, mediator Mojapela says he met with the Prime Minister and his current wife at a Chinese restaurant, where he told them that Dipolilo had agreed to the split. Reuters could not confirm the meeting. Shortly after, Dipolilo was murdered, police say, by a gang. Tabane has been under pressure to resign over the case, which has divided his party and triggered sporadic unrest. The case has been postponed indefinitely.
That was Reuters' Francesca Lana. The European Union is predicting a recession of historic proportions this year due to the impact of the coronavirus. On Wednesday, it released the first official forecast of the damage the disease has inflicted on the bloc's economy. The 27-nation EU economy is predicted to contract by 7.5% this year before growing by about 6% in 2021. The group of 19 nations using the euro as their currency will see a record decline of almost 8% this year and grow by 6.25% in 2021. More than 1.1 million people have contracted the virus across Europe, and over 137,000 have died. Iraq's military says three Katyusha rockets hit near the military sector of the Baghdad airport, causing no casualties. The attack came ahead of a planned session of parliament Wednesday that will vote on a proposed government of the latest prime minister-designate Mustafa al-Kadhimi. Iraqi security forces later discovered the launching pad for the rockets west of Baghdad. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. The U.S. has accused Iran-backed militias of carrying out such attacks in the past. Several attacks targeted U.S. interests in early March, including three military bases known to house U.S. troops. The U.S.-led coalition has withdrawn from several bases across Iraq in a planned drawdown. Nazi commanders signed their surrender to Allied forces in a French schoolhouse 75 years ago this week, ending World War II in Europe and the Holocaust on May 8, 1945. Veterans of the continent's deadliest conflict are finding ways to mark the 75th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day despite virus containment measures. U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee to head national intelligence faces questions at a Senate confirmation hearing. The AP's Mike Gracia reports.
The Senate Intelligence Committee held a confirmation hearing Tuesday for President Donald Trump's nominee for National Intelligence Director. Republican Representative John Ratcliffe of Texas sought to assure the panel he would not be unduly influenced by the president.
My loyalty is to the Constitution and the rule of law. And I have made that very clear to everyone, including the president.
But Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the committee, said,
I still have some of the same doubts now as I had back in August.
After the hearing, Senator Richard Burr, who chairs the committee, promised a quick vote on the nomination. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Media worldwide is facing crises on multiple fronts, exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic used by authoritarian regimes to stifle press freedom. This year's World Press Freedom Day on May 3rd aimed at encouraging the role of the media as a watchdog under the theme, Journalism Without Fear. Zahar Kamiz, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland, discussed the challenges facing journalists in the Middle East and North Africa with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawi.
The challenges are too many to even count when you look at the situation of journalism in the MENA region, the Middle East and North Africa region. Specifically, when you take a closer look at some of the authoritarian regimes in the region, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, others, you see that there's a very clear trend that there is really a lot of restrictions on press freedom. There is lack also of clear rules and guidelines in terms of accountability, transparency. What are the professional criteria by which these journalists can perform their job with fairness, with equity, with balance, with professionalism, without facing dire consequences. The picture is very gloomy. The picture is also very ambivalent. If you're a journalist now trying to practice your work and do your job in terms of trying to inform people, and you're working in one of these countries in this region, you can face countless number of challenges. You can end up in jail. You can end up losing your job altogether, facing dire consequences. And there are many journalists who are behind bars in this region, according to Committee to Protect Journalists, according to Reporters Without Borders, Amnesty International. They all made continuous calls for the release of journalists and for stopping the retaliation by regimes against journalists for simply doing their job and simply trying to make the truth and the reality known for their audiences.
Apart from the current pandemic, hopes for democratization raised by the Arab Spring are fading by the year. Authoritarian regimes continue to openly persecute journalists in the name of combating terrorism and online fake news. What's your take on that?
Unfortunately, this is very true. We have seen this decline, especially in organizations like Reporters Without Borders, Amnesty International have been talking about a decline specifically over the last 4 years, from 2016 up till now. And I believe the worst year was 2018. The journalist Jamal Khashoggi was, as we all know, cruelly murdered in the horrific way that he was. There are so many indications now that indeed using accusations, very false and very broad and vague accusations, like spreading false news, belonging to some kind of banned organization. Many of the journalists who are behind bars in many of these countries are facing these types of allegations, which are very vague, are not defining even terms like what is false news, what is terrorism. They're left out there with very broad words, but at the end of the day, these people lose their freedom, they end up behind bars, they end up being fired, they end up facing very dire, very severe consequences for simply doing their job. The clampdown by regimes in this region is not just anymore on traditional media, as we call it, right? Television and radio, newspapers. We're talking now about also social media. Even a post on a Facebook page or a tweet can get you behind bars. So this is a very alarming situation as well. And it's not only about local and domestic journalists and reporters. There are also cases where foreign journalists and correspondents can also face dire consequences if their narrative is clashing or contradictory to the official governmental narrative.
That was VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy speaking to University of Maryland professor Sahar Kamiz. A Portland, Oregon mother has been bringing some sweetness to those fighting the coronavirus outbreak. As VOA's David Byrd reports, what started as a fundraising effort for a local food bank has brought some home-baked comfort to frontline medical workers.
Whitney Rutz began baking as a way of handling her own stress due to the coronavirus pandemic. But now, Rutz's massive home-baked cinnamon rolls are helping those in hospitals and assisted care facilities. Rutz told the Associated Press she started making the 30-centimeter-wide, 2-kilogram rolls as therapy and as a way to keep her daughter busy at home.
My daughter's birthday party had been canceled. I had two friends diagnosed with COVID-19, and I just kind of lost it. I got really, really sad. I thought, okay, what can I do to cheer myself up and kind of involve my daughter, because now my daughter's going to be home with us.
At first, Rutz was auctioning the rolls. One went for $300. Now she bakes a giant roll for every $500 raised. So far, her efforts have raised more than $35,000 for the Oregon Food Bank, enough to provide more than 105,000 meals. Rutz says since a friend asked that her roll be taken to healthcare workers instead of delivered to her, most of the tasty treats have gone to hospitals and long-term care facilities.
But that second weekend, the person who donated $250 and then had it matched said, you know, I don't want the roll. I live alone. I do not need a giant cinnamon roll sitting in my house all weekend. Please donate it to a healthcare worker. I thought, oh my gosh, well, that is a great idea. So now I would say 90% of the rolls we're making are going to our hospitals, our assisted living facilities, long-term care facilities for the staff to enjoy.
Nurse Jackie Enriquez took two of the rolls to a local emergency department as a thank you for their hard work.
So I brought it to their facility right outside their ER. And my friend that works in the ER, she brought it in, and it just made their day. They cried. I think they had a rough shift.
Enriquez says small encouragements and big cinnamon rolls have made a huge difference to those exhausted by fighting the coronavirus.
And just knowing that other people are out there helping and doing their part and helping outside the hospital, I think really touches us and moves us too. And keeps us going.
Whitney Rutz's efforts have also inspired others to imitate her. Her twin sister and a friend of hers started baking rolls for the fundraising efforts. Whitney's husband, a painter by trade, decorates boxes for the rolls. An acquaintance in North Carolina launched her own fundraiser. Artists and local celebrities have also helped out. But Oregon Food Bank CEO Susanna Morgan said the rolls have brought something else to the table, something that is sometimes in short supply since the pandemic began, joy. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find updates to world events and news 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington, Have a wonderful Wednesday.